This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar, Inc.
Our guest on the podcast today is retirement expert Jamie Hopkins. Jamie is Managing Director of Carson Coaching and the Director of Retirement Research at wealth management firm Carson Group. He's also a finance professor of practice at Creighton University's Hyder College of Business. Jamie wrote the book Rewirement, Rewiring the Way You Think About Retirement, and he's a regular contributor to Forbes Investment News and MarketWatch. Prior to joining Carson Group, he was with the American College of Financial Services, most recently serving as Director of Retirement Research. He received his bachelor's degree from Davidson College, his JD from Villanova University, and his LLM degree from Temple University. He's also a certified financial planner, a chartered financial consultant, and a chartered life underwriter. Jamie co-hosts a podcast that launched earlier this year. It's called Framework. And before we get into the conversation today, we'd like to share a bit of disclosure. CWM LLC, an affiliate of Carson Group, licenses and/or offers products and services of Morningstar and its affiliates. Jamie, welcome to The Long View.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So for our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar, can you give a bit of background on what Carson Group is and what you do for them?
Absolutely. I'll give a little bit of background. And so I've been with Carson Group for about a year and a half. And, you know, my role has changed substantially even over that time period. But going back a little bit before that, I was at American College for almost 7 years and helped head up, along with Professor David Littell, the retirement income program there, which we developed the RICP, Retirement Income Certified Professional designation. And I love that program. It's near and dear to my heart because I helped build it. And Wade Fowle then took over for me essentially in that role. And I came over to Carson Group really to run up at that time about a year and a half ago, the retirement division. So just anything retirement income, retirement related kind of fell into my purview there. And we have at Carson Group about 123 RIAs or IARs that roll into the partnership per se and help support all of those independent advisors out there in the world. Now, this year, things changed a little bit. So, you know, my normal research writing and retirement process related work, Ron Carson, our CEO, asked me to head up one of the other companies that we run, which is Carson Coaching. So we coach about 1,200, 1,300 advisor firms out there on best practice management strategies. So, yeah, I stepped into that role at the beginning of the year, and now I'm fully in that. The retirement stuff still rolls up to me, but honestly, the last couple of months, I've been kind of, moving forward ahead with a lot of our coaching initiatives. We roll out a new LMS and coaching platform this year, which is really exciting. It's about 10 years since the last one rolled out, so much in this digital virtual world, very much in need of seeing a new program. So, you know, excited about that, and yeah, excited to be on the show. I mean, those are kind of the basics, right? So I help a large RIA with the retirement planning and build out a coaching program on the side there. So that's what I spend my time doing.
There seems to be a burgeoning career path for people like you, people who train advisors. Is it your perception that that space is growing a lot, and why do you think that is?
Yeah, so there's definitely a career path in the training of advisors in a lot of different areas. So I've noticed as of recently, too, the number of advisor specialists in the marketing side has grown substantially in the PR side. The retirement income side is where I started really training advisors. And there's a couple reasons for that. One of them is if you look at a lot of the large, you know, mutual traditional insurance companies that were out there, during my time at American College, we saw a number of them actually pull back either on their spend or their internal. We've also seen this move towards independence out there in the world. And all of a sudden, if you're an independent RIA, you don't necessarily have a huge training and development program, right? It might just be you. And so we're seeing more and more need kind of to train or, you know, provide information for those independents or those people where company training has scaled back over the years. So I do expect to see more and more of that. And I expect to see it continue to change. I think a lot of the, you know, traditional ways of doing that, which, you know, American college has been doing that for 90 plus years, and you send out textbooks and you actually take your exams, you know, on these paper things and mail them back in the original days. And that was kind of, you know, really a very early on distance program. And I think the world's trying to catch up to how do we train people more on demand? And I think that's a big challenge just moving forward. How do we get really good on-demand training and education that also keeps pace with time? Because, you know, I helped build a program earlier this year, and I think we've had like three major tax law changes since then. It's like that's a lot of effort that went into kind of a static program that all of a sudden can't adjust to the changing dynamics of the world. So, you know, as we see things, you know, the needs of people change, I think the training and education will change along with it.
Where do you see some of the biggest gaps, whether it's skills or knowledge, that really matter to clients? Maybe if you can give like an example or two where you and some of your clients have been really focused.
Yeah, so I can talk about where I've seen it on my side and also kind of where I see it in the broader profession too. So when we look at a lot of our clients, we kind of break things down into 80-20, right? So we've got our 80% client, which is our more kind of mass affluent, you know, middle America up client. And then we've got our 20%, which is more of our high net worth client. One of the areas that I've been kind of noticing in the high net worth space is a need for more charitable planning. So advisors kind of don't know the ins and outs of foundations, of 501c3s, of charitable work. And that's an area over the last 2-3 years that I've spent more and more time just kind of honing my own skills to help advisors, because that's that 20%. That's the high net worth clients. They're really interested in that. I had a meeting, I was down in Texas this last year, and we, you know, had three prospects in the room for this advisor. And they were all good friends of his. They went to the same golf club, and that's kind of where we were having this dinner, and that's what resonated with all three. I mean, these were, you know, ultra high net worth clients, and I do know after that, you know, we basically went through different charitable techniques, and that's what I was kind of there to talk about from the planning side. And, you know, I know that those people move forward with him because that's what they were really interested in, is that next level meaningful impact. And I think that's an area that advisors are going to start recognizing for that high net worth. Now, when you get to kind of, you know, more average Americans, what are some of the things there? And I think this is something that's being highlighted out there, but I keep saying we're pretty much on like the awareness phase of it, which is just all the behavioral finance pieces. How do we get people to just make smart decisions or informed decisions? And, you know, that's a really challenging thing. We've seen that challenge through this pandemic. I mean, we've seen people move to all cash, right? People trying to time the market. Just so much uncertainty is causing all types of, you know, from an academic standpoint, interesting behaviors. But that's an area that I think advisors and clients need a lot of help with moving forward. And I think where we are on the research and practitioner side of that is I keep saying we're in the early awareness. We kind of know it exists, but to be honest, I don't even think most of the professionals or even academics know all the right things to do yet. We're still learning constantly there. So I expect that to be an area that we see constant kind of improvements on over the years to come. Some of the things that, you know, we used to think worked in the past might not work. And I think we have to keep challenging ourselves there to get better and better.
So that was a question, Jamie, that we had for you, was that idea of all those behavioral foibles and traps that everyone writes about and talks about. Jeff and I had a conversation with Michael Kitsis where he pointed out that the advisor industry really needs to get beyond that sort of identifying mistakes mode and get into behavior change with clients. Do you have any thoughts or any sort of resources that you direct advisors to if they want to try to hone their skills and like helping their clients actually avoid some of these behavioral mistakes?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And Michael writes about it a lot too. And, you know, I think for advisors, if you're thinking of training there's a couple programs out there. There's one that, you know, Dr. Brad Klons and his brother run at Creighton University, which is an excellent program too. And that goes a little bit further into, you know, what things can you actually put in place to help modify behavior, or at least put in a framework of guardrails to kind of help people make better decisions. And, you know, to me, I've started to view it as kind of two different things. And that's one of them is this idea of putting guardrails in place for somebody. So if you go back, you know, some of Shlomo Ben Zari's research, and they had the Save for the Future type of campaign that they rolled out with. And, you know, eventually, right, that became a lot of the automatic enrollment and auto escalation, which a lot of the things that they looked at was you still have to give people a choice, though, right? Like, they have to feel that they're making a choice, right? That's the ability to opt out of automatic enrollment, and then people don't, but they still have that choice. And I think a lot of advisors struggle with that idea of giving people a choice where they want to advise. You know, I ran into that literally this morning where the advisor just wants to tell the client what to do. And I'm like, well, lay it out and let them pick, because there are, you know, there's trade-offs on both sides, whether it's, you know, liquidity, that's what you're trading off, and what you're getting in return is, right, more income. But to some degree, there's not necessarily a right answer there. It's what the client sees is valuable. The other thing is, I've written a couple times this year, there was this notion that we have to get emotions out of investing and get emotions out of personal finance. And, you know, I'm kind of the opinion that, you know, that's, I don't think that's a super helpful statement. The reality is, like, everything's emotional. And, you know, we actually, our brain to some degree craves emotional data. It actually, you know, there's a good amount of research that says, right, that actually our brains make better, more healthy decisions when we do include emotions in it. But again, then it's putting the right guardrails in place so we stay focused on the long run picture instead of getting distracted by short term things. I do think client experience portals, the way we explain information, all of those things can be improved. I wrote an article I published in Kiplinger last year, which I actually kind of brought up the idea that we've probably been, you know, there's a good argument to be made that we've been explaining the benefits of deferring Social Security completely wrong. And we could talk about that as a very concrete example. Now, I haven't tested this, right, from like a client perspective. Does it work? I've done it to rooms of people and presentations, and it seems to resonate. But it's kind of just an interesting thing that, you know, Christine, this is something you'll be very aware of, right, which is, you know, advisors go out and they say, hey, defer Social Security, right, pass full retirement age, and you get an 8% increase in benefits, right? That's like the number one way they probably explain it. And if you take some of the research around like loss aversion is, well, what are you actually telling somebody to do? You're telling somebody to actually take on risk to get a return. The risk is, right, what do most people worry about? Well, kind of two things, right? With Social Security, it's that the program's going to run out of money, or two, that they're going to die early. And those are the two pieces of risk you're telling them to take on for a return. Well, a risk-averse person doesn't necessarily like taking on risk for a return, right? What will they do? They'll actually do the opposite. They're okay taking on risk to avoid loss. And so probably a better way to explain it is just simply a slight change of your words, but it's talking about what you give up if you claim early. And you can kind of go into that and show, hey, here's the present value difference if you live to 90 and what you lose by claiming early. And the reality is we know that the way we just describe something from a gain or loss to people has a big impact. And I don't think most advisors think through that yet when they look at, hey, is my client risk averse or risk tolerant? And, you know, I think that's a very basic example of one, is that almost every advisor I know does the same thing. They say take on risk to get a return with Social Security. The reality is most of their clients might be risk averse, and you're telling them to take on risk for a gain, which they don't like to do. So I think that's like a very basic example of, I think, some of those things we'll find out, you know, as we move forward. Can we get better at, you know, helping clients make the right decisions by framing up the conversation correctly?
That question of choice is so interesting. Jeff and I had a conversation a few weeks ago with Jonathan Guyton, the financial planner, and he talked about using a discretionary fund with his clients where he really gives them some level of control over a portion of the portfolio. Does that type of approach make sense to you?
Yeah, I think it does for probably for a lot of clients. I've helped advisors do this before with certain clients. So we had a client that came in and, you know, was telling us just their story, right? You sit and you listen and just talked about all the different companies he had started over the years with his wife too. They were actually both there and both start their own businesses. And they're definitely, you know, stock pickers when they see something they think is going to be great. And they've been doing that for 40 years, right? And that was somebody who was like, look, you know, you have to give this person the opportunity to have their own discretionary outside fund and just go pick things. You know, that's their spirit, their mentality, and it's going to make them feel, you know, less inclined to come mess with the other side. And I think that's one of those benefits of having something like that, this discretionary. It gives them that choice to go invest and, you know, play in the market. Like Tom Hagna has a, you know, kind of thing about that too, right? Which is his paychecks and playchecks, right? And it's a similar concept that here's your secure piece. We'll take care of that with our investment portfolio. But then your playcheck can be your discretionary one. And that can be your investment assets. And you can decide what you do with that. And often that perception of choice there might make them feel more at ease with the overall plan. So yeah, I like that idea. You know, I don't know if every client, right, you can give them a large enough pool, but maybe, you know, even for some people, if they just have $1,000 or $2,000 that they play with and, you know, their Robinhood account or whatever account it might be with nowadays, it still might make them feel that sense of choice that they are kind of involved.
So then on the other end of the spectrum, there are those who maybe aren't in a position to have a discretionary fund because they've never really had a plan and they're hurtling towards retirement and feeling like they have to play catch up. Can you talk about sort of how it is you would work with an advisor, maybe from an emotional behavioral standpoint, to manage clients like those, to help them to address some of the shortfalls in their plan and address them in a more orderly way than perhaps they otherwise would if they allow emotions to take hold?
Yeah, and I think another thing to recognize on that side is, you know, a lot of what we think of advisors, right, they have a limited number of those people in their planning kind of portfolio of clients, right? That's why I came into this industry and profession is, you know, it's kind of a family story, but, you know, my mom is in her late 60s now, and my dad passed away when I was 8, and neither one of them graduated college, and they're running a construction company together. And my dad passed away, you know, on a job site, an accident there, fell off a roof. And, you know, all of a sudden my mom's got a bunch of kids, never graduated college, and all of a sudden's running a construction company without the person that does all the work. Well, fast forward, right? She got all 5 of her kids through college, 3 of us with graduate degrees of some type now. And she's in her late 60s, still working, but, right, has never been part of a pension program, never had a 401k or, you know, any type of IRA type savings. And you get there and she's almost paid off her mortgage and will be heavily reliant on Social Security and Medicare. And that's kind of America, right? That's the middle America is going to be, you know, maybe get their mortgage paid off nowadays and very reliant on 2 very important government programs. And so a lot of it is, you know, making sure that, you know, the idea of if you can work longer. I mean, I think that's one of the more powerful things out there is, can we keep people in the workforce by keeping their skills up to date, you know, framing their decision to retire on, can you scale back? There was some, you know, really good research done around this too, but I thought of this concept, and sometimes I bring it up with my mom too, is, can you work another year longer? And she goes, I really want time off. I'm like, well, take a month off. Like, that's okay. Like, spend that money, because working another year longer is worth like spending 5-10 grand this year on a vacation. And it's actually the opposite of what a lot of people do when they start nearing retirement. And probably every advisor out there has seen this. They get that client who doesn't necessarily have enough to retire. And the year or two before they decide they're retiring, they decide to really button down, right? They're like, well, we're really going to cut expenses for the next 2 years because we're about to retire. Well, reality is you actually might be better off spending more, going on nicer vacations, you know, and actually staying in the workplace 1 year longer or 6 months longer. So I think that's a really important piece of the conversation that advisors need to have, right? Is the right time to retire, helping them make quality decisions around Medicare, which is not just lowest premium is the best option. making very smart and educated decisions around Social Security claiming, because that's going to be for, you know, two-thirds of Americans in retirement, roughly, right? Their largest source of income. So when we get down to the basics, there's kind of three things, right? It's when to retire, right? Making a good Social Security decision, and then a smart Medicare decision. If we can make those three things kind of in an informed way, that's the majority of what kind of middle America needs to deal with. And so if advisors just keep laying that out and having those conversations about what can we do to stay in the workplace. And I don't think a lot of advisors do, right? They kind of come in, they hear, hey, you want to retire? Then their first thought is, okay, let's look at what you can do to retire. And they don't want to necessarily say no and why, right? Like, no, I don't think it's the best thing for you to retire, and here's why. And then show the impact of working 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, a year longer. And you don't have to fundamentally change their entire goal, but give them that option. Show them what it might look like, and show them what it might look like to spend $5,000 this year to go on vacation if you commit to 6 more months in the workplace.
So, speaking of working longer, what do you think the implications of the pandemic will be for older adults whose plan was perhaps to work longer?
Yeah, the pandemic throws a lot of problems out there. Now, I can tell you some of my thoughts, but that's probably about all they're worth right now. the pandemic, I mean, it's, you know, I'm very pessimistic as it comes to this. So, and I'm pretty much known for that around our workplace. A lot of people call me Dr. Doom as it comes to the pandemic, and I've been pretty negative around it all year. I mean, when we're shooting this, I see a lot of, you know, I think we're at, what, 13 or 14 straight weeks, maybe, of million plus first-time unemployment initial claims. We'll see if that changes after the end of July as the federal funding, the additional unemployment benefit, kind of runs up, at least as current law's written. But, you know, I think it's going to be very hard, which it already was very hard for a lot of, you know, senior workplace employees to find continued employment. And we've had, you know, issues with workplace discrimination in our country for a long time. And I think that the pandemic's actually going to make that harder. I don't think it's going to make it easier. But what I do think it'll open up the door for is more part-time, more distance work, which, you know, is a trade-off that, you know what, if you could work from home and part-time, would you be able to stay in the workplace a little bit longer? Maybe. Obviously, that brings technology challenges to, you know, some of our older employees. But I think so far from the pandemic, I think that we've probably gotten better at that. So I think it'll be a plus and a minus, but my gut feeling is this will not be truly beneficial for those nearing retirement. I think a lot of them, if they lose their job, at least for part-time, will choose not to go back in. You know, we kind of saw this in 08, 09, right, where some of the senior close to retirement age population, if you lost your job, you just retired, right? Like, you didn't go look for another one. And it did force some earlier claiming of Social Security. And we saw the May data seems to imply that, but there could be some other factors going on there. So we'll kind of wait and see how the rest of the year goes. But, you know, that's kind of my gut feeling, is we'll continue to see some improvements in the ability for older Americans to continue to work from a distance aspect. And I think autonomous vehicles helps that too, to be honest. Mobility is often an issue for older workers, but I expect this to be a net negative, at least in the short run.
One outgrowth of the pandemic is that yields are seemingly as low as they can go on safe securities. Is that mainly a concern for people who are in drawdown mode, or is it an issue for retirement savers as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's an issue for a lot of people. I mean, retirement savers too, right? As you start dealing with that group, especially that's looking at retirement income, and they're 55 years old, and they're thinking they may be 10, 12 years from retirement, and they do want to start thinking about de-risking a portfolio a little bit, because there's, you know, again, some good research out there that suggests that 5 years right before and right after retirement are your biggest concerns from a sequencing standpoint, that they want to de-risk. Well, all of a sudden, de-risking doesn't look very attractive right now with, you know, as you said, interest rates basically at zero and negative. And all of a sudden, somebody's saying, why am I going to pull money out of the market to put into anything that's paying zero or negative? I'm just not going to do it. And so we 100% run into clients like that now that are probably, in my opinion, starting to get overweighted in the market because they don't feel that they have a good, safe kind of investment or safer investment style option. And I've had some concerns too with that group and the retirement income drawdown group on being in bond funds. And people can argue about this back and forth. And again, I'm more of a, you know, I don't always necessarily think there's a right answer, but there's things to consider. But we saw some bond funds, right, through the pandemic. We were looking at some on a Friday back in, you know, March or April that lost over 20% of their value in a single day, right? We just had this pull down in bond funds. And all of a sudden, you know, we've been talking about that for years, and academics talk about it, and investment specialists talk about it, that bond funds are not bonds. But you know, the reality is a lot of people's investment portfolio was made of bond funds. And as you had these liquidity draws, and then all of a sudden they're, you know, essentially selling out of bonds and buying new bonds at low rates, these bond funds were just getting crushed. And, you know, you essentially have the person who was doing what they were supposed to do and not selling that was being harmed in that case, because that was supposed to be their safe investment allocation. All of a sudden it's down 20%. And then all of a sudden that person saying, why am I in my safe investment losing 20% when I might as well just be in the market for the upside? And we had people come to us with that conversation too. And insurance products, which would have been nice to buy into probably in the fall, you know, a lot of their interest rates now is tied to the overall Fed rates too, have come down. And I don't think there's a lot of appealing options out there for people today. And that's a true challenge. Where are you going to be properly allocated today if you do need returns? Either you're still saving or your returns from income generation drawdown perspective.
So let's discuss that from the standpoint of withdrawal rates. It sounds like you would probably be in the camp that because of yields being so low, that at least new retirees should be more conservative in terms of setting their initial withdrawal rate. Is that how you would come down on that question?
Yeah, I think so. I struggle with this one too, because, you know, one thing we do know is when markets and things come down, actually, we tend to see a higher actually withdrawal rate possible over time, right? It's kind of the opposite of what's expected, because if you have big drawdowns, you actually tend to see rises. And you don't want to say this time's different, but, you know, I do think depending on how you're invested, you do have to just be conservative with that withdrawal rate. I, however, don't fall so far onto the one side as, you know, my colleague, right, Wade, is, I think since 2010 or 12, been publishing about how the 4% rule might not work. The reality is, since that study was published, probably for 6, 7, 8 years, it probably did work. You know, because you kind of retest 5, 6, 7 years in and you made it through that time period. And, you know, essentially the markets carried through those time periods. And there's some people on the flip side that believe the market might carry through, you know, low safe yields too. I don't know. I mean, personally, I tend to say you need to lower that. I would like to be below 4 today, but I can't necessarily say, you know, that's going to be right or wrong. And I think that gets back to, are you willing to cut back? I think that looking at withdrawal rates is helpful, but again, it doesn't have to be the driver, right? The 4% rule, which in the retirement income space we talk about so much, wasn't designed to be a, you know, retirement income strategy originally. And it really, you know, it's helpful guidance, but it's not kind of the be-all and end-all of things. I've actually fallen more and more into the camp over the years of making sure that you have kind of that floor of income. And that's where I get, even with bond funds and bonds, I care less about the actual returns of everything, but looking at cash flow throughout retirement and saying, what is the cash flow going to look like? So can we meet your spending needs each and every year? Then great. You know, most people, if they came to you for retirement advice and you said, hey, look, we can solve all of your cash flow needs for all of retirement, they'd be great. They don't care if it's a 4.5% withdrawal or a 3.8% withdrawal or a 5% withdrawal. If you can meet the spending needs, you can meet the spending needs. Now, the spending needs for people vary because some want to grow their wealth, some want to spend it down. But I think that's really where you have to get to. So I still look at things today. I know you mentioned some of Guidon's research, and you know, you have other people looking at, should you replace some of your bond portfolio with fixed income, you know, SPIAs or DIAs on the annuity side, and that can actually help move up your payout rate and kind of withdrawal rate at this point too.
Now, can you expand on that? You've written positively about the role annuities can play as a component of a retirement plan. Are annuities even more attractive in this current era of low yields, and what kinds do you tend to gravitate towards?
Yeah, so from a retirement income perspective, I like essentially three different types of annuities, which would be single premium immediate annuities if you just want that lifetime floor of income, a deferred income annuity, and really my view there is just look at the payout rates and see where we can get a better deal, and that's, you know, really should be our deciding factor between the two. But DIAs play a nice role deferring income out a little bit and, again, creating a floor of more secure income. Lately, probably for the last maybe 3 or 4 years, I've been just more interested in the fixed indexed annuities. And sometimes I say equity indexed, and one of my friends, Cheryl Moore, always gets mad at me because she doesn't want me to call them that. But a lot of regulators still call them that, so sometimes I still use the term. But fixed indexed annuities. And, you know, there's been good research. Roger Ibbotson there, too, has talked about this, that if you kind of think about them as replacing the bond portion of your portfolio, they can essentially help you provide a higher payout and return over time than your bonds and CDs can. And so I've really fallen into kind of that category of thinking, which is take some of your safe investments and just see, can you get a better return from an insurance product? And if the answer is yes, then does it make sense to replace that portion? And that's a big change from how those products are sold, though. So if you see, right, the steak dinners where they're selling fixed indexed annuities, it's this whole sales pitch around be part of the market, right? And no downside, right? There's a zero cap on the floor and you get to participate in most of the ride of the market. And it's kind of getting the whole thing wrong. you know, yes, some of those things are true, but really they perform historically closer to, but a little bit better than CDs and bonds. So to me, that's where I start thinking about, you know, the way that these products are sold and positioned today doesn't align with really where they fit into a retirement income plan. So I like seeing those, especially if you're trying to do a bucketing approach. You know, first year cash equivalents is easy. That middle bucket is the hard part. And that's really the whole challenge about bucketing is that, you know, a lot of people go three buckets. It's not subject to that, but three buckets, right? Your short-term needs, right? Midterm and long-term. And that midterm's the challenging one. And I like FIAs in that bucket, filling in that kind of midterm role, allowing your equities and growth portfolios to sit out a little bit longer.
How about advisor sentiment toward annuities? Do you sense that that's changing? Because historically, there's been sort of this cultural bifurcation where you're either an insurance person or you're an investments person. Do you sense that that's maybe changing a little bit?
Yeah, so it's kind of a weird thing. I get asked that a lot. And my answer, like, as soon as people ask me, I'm like, yeah, it's definitely changing. Because I feel that this conversation has opened up a lot. But then when you go look at the annuity sales side, it doesn't look like it's changed all that much. I do think that the sentiment towards them has improved. I think that there's a lot of advisors that are aware that there are uses of annuities in plans. And I think that's where maybe 5-10 years ago, you got more CFPs and, you know, advisors, especially on the AUM model side, saying, oh, we'd never use an annuity. They're terrible. Fast forward, I think you say, yeah, there's definitely good uses of annuities, but we don't really use them that much. And so I don't think the behaviors changed a whole lot. But I do think the recognition around the research from a retirement income standpoint, I think that has made an impact. If you kind of look at the data, right, I mean, variable annuities have been on a decline for probably more than a decade now. And some of the fixed products have seen an uptick. But when we then get back to the really short answer is, you know, to be honest, most advisors do things and recommend things that are squarely within how they get paid. right? That if you're the insurance side, what did you do? You recommended things that you got commissions off of. And if you were on the AUM side, you didn't recommend anything that took AUM, assets under management, away from you. And yes, the media and yes, people like ourselves talk about, you know, true fee-only planners a lot, but it's, I think it's something less than 5% of the whole, right, advice world. So it's, you know, it's a small subset, to be honest, of the impact out there is coming from just a, hey, here's a flat fee or hourly fee. It's a very small percentage of the overall population. So, you know, we still, I see it all the time where an annuity would make perfect sense and the advisor won't do it because they can't get clearly paid on it. I see it with rollovers, probably most disturbingly so. And you see that on both sides, which is the, you know, I just saw one recently. It was about a 5.9% payout, very solid payout from an annuity for a 62-year-old woman, much better than anything you could purchase on the market today. Advisor still very much of the mindset they need to bring the assets over, and really not a whole lot of numbers behind it, but very clear that the idea was either this is going to be a payout from a government plan and I will charge nothing on it, or we do a lump sum rollover and I'll manage it. And that's, you know, unfortunately still the driver for a lot of people. Sometimes I think the advisory world actually gets too much criticism around this. This is how people behave in every profession and world, is your compensation drives your decision-making, right? It has an impact. That's why people get paid to do things, because we know that payment does change how you do something, right? It's why commissions, it's why sales quotas, right? It's why everything from a financial standpoint is out there to some degree, is because it drives behavior to some degree. So it's not, you know, only an issue for our profession, but it has a big driver when it comes to the usage of annuities and retirement income planning.
I wanted to shift and talk about withdrawals and specifically the CARES Act. You've been doing a lot of work on the CARES Act, which makes it easier for retirement plan participants to gain access to their funds. Before we go into the specifics of that, where do you come down philosophically on the question of how much access people should have to their retirement funds? On the one hand, you know, urgent financial needs are just that, but on the other, you know, most people in this country are undersaved for retirement to begin with.
Yeah, I think the whole idea of leakage from plans, you know, fundamentally is a concern, right? What we don't want to see is people using retirement assets for everything else under the sun. That being said, I also think it's important to recognize that our lower income, middle income individuals might not have as many other options. You know, finally, the CARES Act is something that, you know, I don't know why it took so long to get this, but just the ability to put the money back in. I mean, we kind of had this sense like, hey, if you take your retirement money out, we might give you some type of exemption so you can use it, but we'll never let you save it again. And that to me is, you know, I think the idea of loans and repaying them to yourself, that makes a lot of sense. And I definitely fall into that category. I would probably modify more things to allow, you know, kind of hardship style loans from IRAs. I mean, I think that there's some common sense changes we can make to IRAs that we learned from the 401k market and employer market that we just haven't made those decisions. But I probably said a lot of things there. Simple answer is I do worry a lot about leakage from retirement assets. But two, I think we have to recognize that a lot of people don't have access to other funds. So is it great when we see people are saving for retirement but are carrying monthly credit card debt? I think the answer is no. They might actually not be helping themselves. So especially in a time like now, recognizing that people are losing their jobs and giving them access with the ability to put the money back in over time is probably a good public policy.
So you mentioned that you would support the idea of putting some of the features of 401k plans over to the IRA environment. What might those be?
Yeah, so the biggest one is just getting rid of these income limits, you know, in the sense of $5,000-$6,000. I thought that's, you know, one of the things that makes the least amount of sense to me out there. So, right, you're a middle income making $70,000, $80,000 a year, right? You can't even put 10% of your savings into an IRA, right? But if you had a job at a 401k, you could put twice as much in, right? That to me is just kind of a misalignment. I think that we have to recognize that especially IRAs today are probably going to become, you know, and have become to some degree the savings vehicle for a lot of our self-employed, right, small business owners that are out there. And so I think just kind of aligning those across the board and saying, hey, look, you can put $57,000 into a traditional IRA and aligning that with 401ks so we're not just getting people who make $1 million a year max funding both of them. And again, there's alignment there already, right? If you, you know, active participant based off your income levels, it phases out, but at least for the deductibility portion. But I think aligning those, I mean, that's a very simple one. Just recognize that we have a lot of people who are not in workplace plans and they need a better place to save. I do think the, you know, we've always recognized that at the employer level, right, 401k loans are a positive thing. Well, let's have IRA level loans too. Obviously, there's some other concerns just about abuse there. I think with a lot of things on abuse, the way that people view it is wealthy people taking advantage of otherwise looking tax breaks to just further increase their wealth. And so you can always put, you know, income caps on certain things if that's your concern, or you could even put wealth caps on. If you have a $6 million IRA, sure, you can put some limitations on that. But I think where I would like to see is actually IRAs looking more in the sense of true retirement funding vehicles instead of really what they are today as rollover vehicles.
When the market was down a lot more, there was a lot of chatter about this being a good time for people to take a look at IRA conversions. Have they missed their opportunity now that things have come back?
So it is a good thing to bring up, right? Like if the market drops, it's a great time to convert. However, essentially what you're trying to get into there is some type of market timing, right? So yes, if you believe your assets are depreciated in value, is it a good time to convert? Probably. I still think 2020 is a fantastic time to do Roth conversions, but it should be up to the individual. So this is what I always kind of do with people is I just ask them some very basic questions about this. I say, looking out at the world today, do you believe that your tax rates are going to go up in the future or down? Right? Just ask people that. And you know what? Very few people believe that tax rates are going down in the future. They didn't believe that earlier this year. And I'm sure with CARES Act and $6 trillion being pumped into the economy, federal deficits, it's very hard to look out there and believe that, you know, tax rates are going to keep going down in the future. In fact, right, even if you just base your answer off the current law today, Tax Cut and Job Act goes away at the end of 2025. And you go back to, for most people, higher effective taxes. So when should you do conversions? You should do conversions when your tax rates are, you know, lower when you're converting than when you pull the money out in the future. So to me, I think that is probably the main driver for most people. And I think the answer is, you know, I'm a believer for sure that tax rates are going up in the future. I just don't see how long term the country can continue to run a deficit as it does with low tax rates, less revenue coming in, right? So I think that should be a big driver. The other thing is, I think all things being equal today, Roth IRAs are typically better than traditional IRAs. Roth money is better, right? You know, you don't have RMDs at age 72. Under the Secure Act, this 10-year stretch provision, it's clear you'd much rather have a Roth than a traditional IRA if you inherit, right? So from an estate and beneficiary planning standpoint, it's beneficial. From Social Security and Medicare premiums and taxes, it appears to be better. So there's a lot of benefits today for Roth. But I think from an advisor and recommendation standpoint, I mean, one, you can always ask your client that and they can make the decision. But two, I think probably for advisors, it should come down to tax diversification, which is just a lot of your clients are going to have most of their money in tax-deferred retirement accounts, meaning that they're very subject to changes in future tax laws, not just rates, but tax laws. They essentially have one tax vehicle, and as laws change, it'll impact them, right? Positively or negatively, you know, more on both sides. So from a diversification standpoint, I think it's great to have Roth money. So to do conversions to get it there, great. To have, you know, tax deferred money, good. And to have just total after tax money, also good. I mean, that's really where we want to get clients if we can do true planning there.
So another aspect of the CARES Act was the suspension of required minimum distributions. Do you think it makes sense for Congress to write legislation that would automatically trigger a suspension if stocks drop below a certain percentage in a given year, rather than having to patch things together at the last minute in the midst of a crisis?
That's a really good question. I haven't thought much about, you know, this suspension based on, you know, market drops. So to be very honest, I'm actually not a huge fan of the suspension of RMDs. And I'll tell you why. Is the reality is, right, the vast majority of retirees need their distributions anyways. I think it's what, less than a quarter, 20% or so actually don't take out more than their RMD each year. So the reality is that suspension of RMDs essentially helps a group of people who don't need the income, that are trying to grow their wealth in retirement. And that's okay, right? That's our 20%, our higher net worth client base. But when I look from public policy, typically what I think on public policy is I'm usually more concerned with the 80%. And actually the RMD amount is a good spending measurement. So I'd actually probably be, you know, contrary to most advisors not wanting to hear this too, I think they should expand RMDs out a little bit, include Roth IRAs too, actually. So I know that doesn't get a lot of favor with advisors when they're like, but you just told us one of your favorite things is that they don't get RMDs. I'm like, yes, it's a very good feature. But I like RMDs. I think it's a very good tool for a lot of retirees. But the notion of, you know, if we have 40% drawdowns in the market, is a good year to, you know, pull out your money? No, but I think that should get to, for those people who have enough income to kind of understand where your income is coming from each year, and to still have flexibility to not have to sell out of the market during those years to provide your, you know, retirement cash flow. And I think that gets back to planning, not so much should we have a taxable distribution from a retirement account. So it's, a lot of people could just buy back in if they didn't need to spend the money anyways, just on the outside.
One question for you, Jamie, about the CARES Act was that until very recently, there was major confusion about people who took their required minimum distributions earlier in the year and whether they would have the opportunity to put it back. Now it seems that that's solved and they can do that until the end of August. But I guess the question is, like, why was that so complicated? And do you think it was just an indication that the legislation was kind of a mad scramble there in the midst of the crisis?
Yeah, the CARES Act looks like it was drafted in 2 weeks, and it's because it was drafted in 2 weeks. it's been the perfect example of, right, like the building a plane while you're flying or learning how to fly when you're already in the air. I mean, we're getting so many retroactive changes to things. This one I thought was unnecessarily complicated, you know, that it just took so long to get a simple solve in place. And there's some real questions about the solve too. I could go into that for a second here, but so essentially, right, they waive RMDs for the year, but it's end of March, right? Like March 27th, I think, when the CARES Act passage, which means a lot of people were taking monthly distributions January, February, March. Some people just take all of their distribution out in January. January actually became really the problem area. And then eventually we got this IRS notice, I think 2020-51. And that went ahead and say, hey, look, you will extend out the 60-day rollover all the way out to the end of August. And this won't count against the once every 12-month IRA 60-day rollover rule. Okay, solve in place. Additionally, they said that you can go ahead and do rollovers from inherited accounts if you took the RMD during that time too. And it's something that Jeff Levine and I have talked about. You know, to some degree, you know, we're not sure the IRS should have fixed this in the way that they did. We're probably both in favor of this being fixed. We get a lot of questions about how do I fix my January distribution because I was proactive and I'm now getting punished for not, you know, waiting longer to take my RMD out. But the reality is there's very clear rules regarding, you know, rollovers. There's very clear rules that rollovers from inherited accounts are not allowed from Congress. And so to some degree, we've entered a slippery slope. As you know, I'm an attorney. And what you don't like seeing, though, is just because something feels right, it shouldn't have regulations overturning very clear congressional laws. So, you know, Jeff and I have talked about that. We're both kind of like, hey, we're glad that the outcome is there. But honestly, Congress should fix this if it's a problem, because we really should not get into the world of just having regulatory changes because they don't like something that Congress had passed. Yeah, they passed a new bill, but they chose not to make those changes. And the HEROES Act did have some of those changes in it, right? So they proposed a new bill in the House, got to the Senate, still stuck. But that bill was supposed to deal with this RMD aspect. And so I do think there's some clear questions here of whether or not, you know, the IRS overstepped in its rulemaking. I don't know who's harmed by it, so I don't really know who would challenge that. But I think there are some real clear questions there, because I don't see how they have the authority to allow rollovers from inherited accounts when they're clearly prohibited.
Maybe in our last question, we'll widen out a bit. We had a great conversation with Carl Richards a few months ago. And as you know, a big focus of his is that advisors should help clients in a more holistic way to align their time and money with their life's goals. Do you agree that this will be a big part of the future of advice, financial advisor as life coach, so to speak?
I do agree with that. Actually, one of the first things I helped work on when I got to Carson Group a year and a half ago as part of the client experience portal. And one of those things is actually a timeline of events. And so essentially all the things that the advisor helped with over the course of their relationship, and that being part of one of the documents that's produced for every client review. Because so many client reviews get focused on, hey, here's the investment returns. And the reality is the advisor has no impact on the investment returns. So how well the client review goes is based on the market, which you have no control over. But what you did have control over, which is, you know, hey, your kid, you know, went to this college, we helped fund this 529. Great, right? We refinanced a house at this time. Great. Getting that more holistic view of someone's life and kind of the life cycle of finance and helping them save in times of abundance, plan for the future, and really focus on those life events, I think is very important. That's going to drive better behavior too, going back to one of the earlier pieces, is when people can actually envision their future self and future decisions, they, you know, tend to make more informed kind of stay to the path plan type of decisions a little bit better. And that's some research out of UCLA about the future self from a couple years ago that's really powerful. And, you know, I think a lot of what Carl talks about there is going to be true. There's definitely a move towards this more holistic planning out there. And I mean, that's true. You know, I've worked with a lot of the largest insurance providers and multi-lines for many years. And even in those places, which have been more product-centric, they're continuing to move forward towards more holistic planning to get those agents and advisors to think more holistic. You know, CFPs definitely under that mindset of trying to think more holistic. Asset managers, right? Adding all types of different technology and services to think more holistic. And that's where we have to go. If you just think about it from the selfish standpoint, people want to keep their clients for life, not one-off transactions. So they want to keep them through the accumulation, through the nearing retirement, and through the decumulation. And so a more holistic approach will help them better serve the client across all of those different life cycles.
Well, Jamie, we've really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks so much for your time and insights and sharing them with our listeners. We really appreciate it.
Jeff and Christine, thank you so much for having me on the show. I've been listened to it many times, so it's a pleasure actually being on myself.
Jamie, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View for Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYouth and the number 1. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Batak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar, Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.